This week on the BOAG World Show, we talk about getting better copy from clients, to code or not to code, and following the brief. This week's show is sponsored by Proposify and Awards. Show the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development, and strategy. My name is Paul Bauer. Joining me on this week's show is Andy Clark, Sam Barnes, Marcus Lillington, and Ryan Taylor. Hello, all.
Top of the morning to you.
See, I tried to do an enthusiastic intro, and then it's like,
so early in the morning. I've only just finished my breakfast cereal.
Well, Andy, it's your fault that we're doing this early in the morning.
Yes, I know.
So don't give me that.
I know.
And your, I'm going to be in Australia. We'll need to do it for my time zone. And are you in Australia? No.
Not yet. No, we're still here. Although,
any news?
No, we just have to wait until the immigration people say, come on in, hopefully, touch wood. It's really strange, though. Last week, every day, I got a new present from a mystery buyer through the post. So...
You talk about this positively. That sounds quite creepy.
No, well, it's really strange. It came to the business address and obviously addressed to me. And the first day was a pair of Australian hats, green hats with the corks hanging around them.
Right.
And then the next day was a book as a translation, like English to Australian translation guidebook.
And you've no idea who this is from?
No idea at all.
I never, ever... get gifts. You seem to get them all the time.
Well, it is strange. I did get some Marmite sent to me with malarkey written on it a few weeks ago. But, you know, people do tend to send me some nice things every now and again. They don't send me stuff off eBay that I ask for, you know, like...
Yeah, that's because the stuff you ask for on eBay costs like $3,000 or something.
Yeah, well, ultimately, I did find out who it was that sent me this stuff. By the end of the week, I'd kind of figured it out and he coughed to it. And it's a good job that I managed to catch him before he actually sent the inflatable kangaroo that he had on in his shopping cart.
Well, I would have thought that's a perfect gift.
Well, you know, I was actually quite excited about receiving it.
Yeah, you shouldn't have stopped him.
No, I know. But let's move swiftly on.
I just don't even want to know. So this whole doing it in the morning sucks. Because I was up until like 3 a.m. or something playing Civ. I can't stop playing Civilization for some reason. It's becoming a problem. I'm not, between that and the drone, I'm not doing any work anymore.
That was the plan though, wasn't it, Paul?
Well, yeah, no. I mean, I guess so.
This is your dream, playing games and going outside. I mean, that's a step up for you, really, isn't it?
Oh, ha, ha, ha. You're so funny.
Going outside is
a playing related. Games at your age till 3 a.m. Goodness.
Well, yeah. Why not, really?
Same as a guitar, right?
And also, Civilization, I mean, it's educational, right?
Is it?
Well, no.
All games are educational.
Are they?
I'm pretty sure that Jack's math skills are as good as they are because he's been playing games.
It is true. I have to say most of my son's education has come through World of Warcraft. In fact, at the moment he's doing business studies, at GCSE. And in that, you do a big thing about economics and you know, stock markets and fluctuating prices and all that kind of stuff. And he knows it all. And he knows it all from the auction house in World of Warcraft.
Yeah, that's cool then, isn't it?
It is.
So, Paul, you're what they call.
Yeah, you're doing the right thing, staying up till 3 a.m. playing games.
There we go. That's sorted. That's good.
What is Civ anyway?
Civilization. What do you do? It's a kind of, it's like Risk on steroids.
Sorry. Oh, right, so you have to kind of take over other people's territory and that sort of thing.
Yeah, but you can do it, you can win in lots of different ways. So you can win through the Risk method of just general military, the what I like to call the Donald Trump approach to winning, which is just bullying everybody else into submission. Or you can win through being the first to win the space race. So you can do it
that way. Victory.
Yeah, scientific victory. Or you can win through civilization victory. In other words, you become the like dominant civilization. And, you know, everybody is influenced by you, basically. So there are different ways of winning. And you start off with a little nomadic tribe and go all the way through. So you develop, you know, all your sciences and all of that kind of stuff all the way through to the space race. Right. It's actually really good. It's very good. And you can play as different nations. So I tend to play as the Romans because they get legions early on.
Do you think you play differently now that Trump's the president and he makes decisions and you finding yourself thinking, I won't do that?
Well, interestingly, I posted to Instagram a screenshot of my game. Where essentially I've just decimated the environment. So actually I think I'm going in the other direction. Right. I think I am essentially becoming Donald Trump in the right. game, which is quite disturbing, but you know, there you go. Yeah, am I the only one that plays games then? Am I the only one that hasn't grown up?
I play games a lot.
I play as well, yeah.
Okay, so you two are both staying quiet.
I was replaying Telltale's The Walking Dead last night.
Now, that's really interesting because I'm actually a big fan of story-based games. So yeah. Things like Tomb Raider, Uncharted, yeah. Last of Us, that kind of thing. But I've never played a Telltale game. Are they good?
I really enjoy them because the stories are so good, but it's a stretch to call them a game. They're almost like, you know, you remember the old novels that you used to read and you get to page 100? Yeah, choose your own adventure. And yeah. They're like that. So like choices you make do influence the story, and like if you don't save a certain character, then they'll be dead in the next episode and things like that. So, but it, you know, once you've played through it a couple of times, you can see where the kind of pivot points are, and like you can experience all the different routes through. But when you on your first playthrough, it feels like a story that's very tailored to the choices that you've made. I really enjoy them. I use them as kind of a palate cleanser between games. So when I've played something like The Witcher 3 and I'm moving on to another game, I'll play like a Telltale game to just kind of just settle me down. It's nice and easy. It's a nice story. Then I'll get to end. Well, nice story. It's Walking Dead. So it's people eating each other's faces off. But you know, it's very well told. You know what I mean? They're very high standards. They're kind of one of those companies that everything they put out is kind of, the stories are excellent. You know, they're very good.
I might have to give one a go then, because sometimes you haven't got the end, you know, playing something like, I don't know, well, even something like The Last of Us or Uncharted, you know, it takes coordination. You need to be awake.
Yeah, that is exactly what you don't need with these games. You just sit back and just take them in. It's like reading a novel.
Yeah.
Start with season one of The Walking Dead, and if you don't like that, you won't like the rest of them. But if you do like that, you've got about 10 other series that you can actually try with Telltale.
But there are others as well. They do Game of Thrones, don't they?
Game of Thrones are pretty good. They do The Wolf Among Us, which is based on a comic book series called Fables.
Okay.
Which is really good. That got me into the comic book series, so they ended up reading 200 comics off the back of just playing that game. So like, oh, Jesus, this is brilliant, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So you play the odd game.
What do you play, Marcus?
About every couple of years, something comes along that I really like, and they're usually puzzle-type games. Limbo was probably the best game I've ever played. And Machinarium, I don't know how you spell it, but basically, or pronounce it rather, but it, you know, games where you have to go and find things and work out to rescue the whatever. You have to rescue the princess. Wonderful looking game, amazingly good, graphics, I thought, and soundtrack.
I hate puzzle solving games. They make me feel thick.
That's why I only play Street Fighter.
Yeah, exactly.
I still haven't moved beyond playing Street Fighter 2, and I've got, you can get them now for the iPhone. I mean, they haven't been updated for years, but you can actually play Street Fighter on your
awesome.
iPhone, which is great. So Hadouken and all of those kind of things.
I'm going to tell you. You'd like the look of Limbo, though. You should just download it just to look at it, because it's gorgeous.
The one thing that I did play fairly recently and really, really, really loved was Monument Valley on the iPhone.
Oh, God.
Oh, that's beautiful. Good.
Yes, yeah. Wonderful. You see, that's another example of one. I keep thinking an update will come along for it. And it's, they've done some more. No, they haven't. They need to.
No, I did like that, Monument Valley. What about you, Sam? What do you play?
Compared to you lot, I'm so basic. I'm like Call of Duty and FIFA. I do like the story games, but the truth is I kind of get a bit too involved, but I will sit there for nights and nights on end, like you're doing, I guess, at the moment.
Yeah.
And guess what? Nothing else gets done. So I kind of have to find ways of getting my fix, I guess you could say, but something I can sort of dip into and dip out.
Call of Duty's great. I enjoy that. I don't understand the appeal of FIFA, but then, you know, football.
Yeah.
Also, I don't get that.
I bought The Last of Us for Dan for Christmas and he's still not played it yet. He says he ain't got time. I said, you live with your girlfriend. I've got three kids and I put 500 hours into The Witcher 3. It's not that you haven't got time. It's just not a priority.
Yeah, which is probably healthy, to be honest. The fact that you've got three kids and you put 500 hours into Witcher 3
Over an 18-month period, not all in one city. You know what I mean? It was over an 18-month period. It was a couple of hours on night, you know.
Yeah, I had that. I don't think... Oh, yeah. Couple of hours a night, that's quite a lot when you've got three kids.
I don't go to the pub, I don't drink, I don't, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just, that's my escapism.
So there we go, that's interesting. Ryan, I think Telltale, that's the way to go. I can go for that. I might be downloading. No, I don't need another game at the moment.
Well, the nice thing with that is that each episode's only about a couple of hours long. So, you know...
Oh, is it?
Yeah. The whole series is about 10 hours. So it's not like you're not losing your life to it. It's just...
Yeah.
It's like a novel, you know, like reading a book.
Well, the problem I've got today is that I'm a bit torn, really, because I want to play Civ, because I'm in a really tricky position at the moment. Yeah, outside...
Do some work.
Outside it's really foggy and misty and everything's gone monochrome. So I want to take the drone out. So what do? And work doesn't get a look in. Anyway, talking of work, what the answer, you see, is you don't make money by actually doing anything. You get sponsors on the podcast.
Oh, who are the sponsors this week, Paul?
Same people as every week, Andy.
It sounded like so much like Pinky and the Brain then.
Do we?
Yeah, oh, just that you remember that on the credits for Pinky and the Brain, where you used to go, what are we going to do tonight, Brain? We're going to take over the world. It just sounded like that. What's it tonight, Paul? Well, it's the same people as every night. Do you remember that beginning of...
No.
I
don't remember.
No, I have no idea what you're talking about.
We have to link to it.
Andy, you don't come out very well off of that analogy. Because you are Pinky, who is this kind of stupid, moronic idiot. Well, I presume I'm the brain, based on Ryan's description, which, you know, immediately sounds...
Yeah, I'm not going to challenge those assumptions.
We will let it pass. Yes, no, it's awards again. So last couple of weeks we've been talking about the fact that I am speaking at an awards event and hosting, actually. And if you remember, I was terrified about doing all the names and stuff. But that has come and gone. Well, at least it has in terms of when this podcast comes out, although I've still got it to do in reality. I thought I'd tell you a bit more about awards generally. So as you've gathered, they do events, they do conferences, that kind of stuff. But you might guess by their name that they do awards as well that recognize talent and effort in the web design community. So they kind of highlight the best web designers, developers and agencies in the world. They've also got a magazine that they put out, and they put out various books where they feature some of the amazing works of the attendees. So it's an incredible place to get kind of inspiration and be inspired about what's going on. Very, very creative stuff. I mean, you can tell from the lineup of the conference speakers that I talked about last week, where you've got people like Brendan Dawes and Mike Coos and various other people, that they are very creative and they have a very broad kind of type of designs that they show, which I think is really good if you're looking for good sources of inspiration, that you don't look too narrowly. Finally, they also have got a professional directory where you can find agencies. They've got a job board if you're looking to move organization. They're a huge organization, actually. They do a lot of really cool stuff. So if you are interested in any of that and you want to check them out, or you want to get some inspiration for your next project, then go along to boag.world/awards. And awards is spelt with 3 W, as in www. So AWWWARDS. Okay. So recommendations, tips and advice time. I actually thought I'd kick off, if that's all right, guys.
Go for it, Paul.
I didn't get a go last week, did I? It was very sad. So I'm going to have a go this week. So really, I want to talk about copy and getting copy from clients, or more specifically, getting good copy from clients. Because let's be honest, this is often the kind of bane of most projects, that you do some great user interface work, you know, you've built an amazing content management system and, you know, everything's looking great. And then your clients or stakeholders, if you're internal, just kind of vomit shit copy all over it. And that kind of somewhat...
Lovely analogy.
Well, yeah, it does feel like that, doesn't it, sometimes? So how do we maybe improve the copy that they're producing and, how do we improve the copy they're going to produce? So I've got basically three little tips I want to share with you that are kind of all interlinked with one another. The first is... I think part of the problem is that clients don't really have a, they don't really know how to write great copy for the web. They've not done it before, many of them. And so they need some help and some guidance. But it's quite difficult with limited budgets and times. It's not really always your job to advise them. So what I tend to do is kind of whittle it down to suggesting that every page that they write, they ask three questions. All right. And I encourage them to address these before they start writing on the comment, the content. So I say, one, who is the page aimed at? So they answer that first, then answer what questions of the user that the page is aimed at are you answering? So that is question number two. And then thirdly, I say to them, decide what you want the user to do next before you start writing. So if they just do those kind of three things, if before they start writing, answer who it's aimed at, what questions those people have and what you want them to do next, then the whole thing goes a lot smoother. And the content is more focused. Now, to help them do that, and to provide a little bit of structure, you might want to check out a product called Gather Content. Has everybody heard of this?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I haven't.
Oh, good, good. One person hasn't. Thank you, Ryan, for being the thickie.
It's all right. So Gather, I'm gonna do my segment in a minute.
I'm sure you're going to blow me away. So Gather Content is essentially gathercontent.com. It's basically a tool that clients can put their content into. That means it's easy for you to then get it out and do put it in databases and things like that. But the other good thing about Gather Content is that you can add in extra fields. So you can add a field before they start putting in their copy of who is this page aimed at, what questions are you answering, and what do you want the user to do next. It's kind of to make sure that it becomes a part of their workflow. So that's something you might want to check out. Now, you could do the same thing in a Word document, obviously, but having some kind of template that they fill in when they're creating content will help them focus them on the three questions. Of course, all of that isn't necessarily going to result in really well-written web copy. Now, again, you could send them on training courses. You could spend hours kind of coaching them. Not always practical. So that brings me on to the third little thing that I wanted to recommend, which is something called Hemingway App. Again, you heard of this one?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I talk about this stuff too much. So Hemingway App is essentially a little tool that's designed to help people write good web copy. It's at hemingwayapp.com, and you can just pop your copy into it, and it will make suggestions about how to improve it, shorten sentences, remove adjectives, just kind of tighten up your copy. Now, it's not infallible and it's not perfect, but it is a good starting point if you want to write better web copy, and I always pass everything I write for the web through this tool.
It winds me up, Paul.
Yeah, I know it would do. But that's because you're used to writing proposals, which is a different thing.
Yeah, and I've got a habit of, mid-sentence going off onto another thought on top of that sentence and then coming back to the other one. And it just, that's it. Very hard to read. You can't, and it's like, is it really very hard to read? And it's just that kind of conversation tends to go on when I'm reviewing stuff I've written.
But you see, the thing is, You've got to remember this tool, in my opinion, it's not suited in every circumstance. It's suited for writing web copy.
Yeah.
And the reason that that would be marked as very hard to read isn't necessarily because it's hard to read, but because it's hard to scan.
Mm. Yeah, you can't take it in quickly.
Yeah, if you've got long sentences, then it's very hard to kind of process those sentences, especially if they're, you know, chopping and changing thought partway through. So you've got to remember what it's good for and what it's not. Like I said, it's not perfect, but it is another useful tool. Mm. So there are my tips for encouraging clients to write better web copy. Sorry. And if nothing else, Hemingway will give you the reading level of your copy. And so often, like with academics, for example, we do a lot of work with universities. Their reading level is like 14, 15, 16, which is way too high for people on the web. Sorry, Sam, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, has anyone tried, I use a Chrome extension, Grammarly, which has been heavily advertised, but actually I find when I'm doing little bits, like the real-time thing within the browser is quite nice, actually. It's picked me up on a few decent tips, actually. So that might be something for when people are entering in CMSs rather than having to put things into another app sort of thing.
It's Grammarly's really good, actually. Yeah. I really like it. I didn't use it. See, I don't use Chrome as my main browser, which is kind of why I didn't use it. But it, and also, they do have a desktop app, I think, but it's chargeable, and I'm very tight. So, Ryan,
I was just going to say, I think it'd be bad of us not to say as well that there is real value in hiring an actual content person, a copywriter, or a content strategist.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I mean, absolutely, 100%. This is the cheap and cheerful approach, you know. But, you know, you're entirely right. Wherever possible, you want someone that actually knows what they're doing.
The worth of weight in gold.
And I never understand that, right? How clients are quite happy to spend a fortune on design or even on a content management system, yet both of which are basically packages for the content, and yet they won't spend money on the content.
What I've found, the reason for that is it's because, you know, essentially they don't think they can do that other stuff, but they do believe they're so into their own world, their own business, that they are the best ones to write that copy.
Yeah, so we have this argument with client, not argument, discussion, with actively discussing with clients quite a lot, in that they can know their product or their business better than anybody else, but that doesn't make them qualified to write advertising copy, exactly, which is you know, generally what we put on the web. So you need to actually either get to, you know, hire somebody to do that, or what I've tried to do over the sort of past few years is to basically get them to tell me rather than to produce the content. So if you sit somebody down in front of a blank Word document, what they'll do is they'll go, Stuff and Nonsense is the leading website design company established in 1997. And they'll write this kind of drivel. Whereas if you do Paul's approach and you say to somebody, so why should somebody, you know, come to your studio rather than somebody else? What is it that they'll tell you in natural language?
Yeah.
And that's the stuff that you can write down and then kind of massage into copy.
I always have this rule of thumb with copy that if you can't say it with a straight face out loud to somebody in a conversation, then something's gone horribly wrong. Because it's so often it's like, you know, imagine in a pub, you're sitting down with someone and they say to you, so what is it that you do? And you say, well, actually, I work for a leading web design company that creates synergy in the user experience space. You know, you sound like a dick.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We write that all the time for our website, you know.
Speak for yourself.
But you know what I mean. You know what I get at.
I sit down and say, welcome to Marcus Lillington.
Yeah. That's how you talk in the pub, isn't it? It's amazing. When I sit down with pub, I go, hi, I'm Boag World, and I have a podcast for those that run websites. Yeah, I've lost it. Yeah, so... content is a hugely important area, and it doesn't get enough mentioned. So, my tips and my advice are really the kind of quick and dirty, if that's all you can do approach. Absolutely, Ryan, hire a professional, as with all things. Sam.
Yes.
You wanted to talk about coding.
Kind of, yeah. I thought I would talk about something that I'm asked quite a lot, and I think I've probably been asked it ever since I got into this industry, to be honest. And that is, really, should people like project managers, account managers, designers, basically non-production people for thereabout, should they know how to code? Right. Now, we've seen this talked about, I think, you know, as I say, for years and years and years. I think everyone has different answers. So just like give mine, and why I think what I do. Really, my answer is always, in an ideal world, yes. But in reality, I think that actually, no, they don't need to know how to code at all. But it does help so much if these people just get some really basic foundation knowledge in their brains. So, I mean, what I've always found is that it's actually more important for these people to be seen to be trying to understand this stuff more so than actually getting it and doing it. All right. So, you know, no one has to become a competent developer, but just by getting that basic foundation knowledge, they can increase their effectiveness in their job, no matter what they do, plus get the respect of their team, which in my experience actually goes an awful long way. So, you know, it's like, if you take a project manager before knowing some technical basics to after, I can pretty much guarantee that both them and the team would deliver a better result and probably enjoy themselves a little bit more as well. Same for anyone selling work. Same for anyone involved in any aspect that kind of impacts on a production team. But, you know, often you'll find that these people won't do that. They won't try. And they'll either think they don't have to, or they will actually think they can't. And that's also sometimes met with people, you know, on our side who will actually perhaps not be the best teachers, won't have the patience, won't want to do this stuff. I mean, I've seen it where I've got non-production people to actually approach technical people to want to learn, and they've kind of been patronized without even realizing. We kind of forget what we know, I think, is my main point. So I guess I've just put a few sort of tips out there on how you can get started, really, because I do think it's really important. But it's such a big, scary topic, I think. And again, I think that when you've been doing this for years, you really forget what you know. I don't know how much experience you guys have with, like, you know, taking on juniors or whatever, but sometimes when you're dealing with someone that knows very little, it's, you suddenly realize how much you've picked up over the years, how much you take for granted. It just becomes second nature, really. So I just thought I'd suggest, you know, a couple of things to get going. So obviously the first one is to actually find people within your organization or online who seem to be willing to teach you the basics, you know, to understand where you sit, what level you're at, and they've got that patience to talk to you. But I appreciate that's quite difficult. So a couple of articles that I found that were kind of pretty amazing, actually. So the first one, I'll put these on the show notes. There's one called What is Code by Paul Ford, and it's the longest article I think I've ever seen. And it's written from the perspective of someone who literally knows nothing about technology or code. Like, I think that he sets up the premise that you're kind of an exec in an office, and suddenly these computer guys have to do stuff. So you're wearing your suit, you're earning lots of money, and suddenly a guy in casual clothes and a laptop comes in and starts telling you how to run your business. What's that all about? And it kind of tries to take the mindset of that kind of person to the point where they can understand who this person is in front of them and why they might want to give them some time, essentially. But the trouble with that one is it's got a good mix of cultural background, but it's also got quite a lot of computer science type stuff in there, which I found quite hard going at times. So the second article I'll put in the show notes is a bit more sort of for the layman. That's by a PM called Adam Edgerton, and that's called Full Stack Basics for the Non-Developer. And that's kind of a bit more humorous, a bit more, I don't know, a bit more lighter, and talks about it from more of a kind of a small agency type perspective, which I think is where most people would find it easier to start. And then finally, just try some practical free courses such as Code Academy or Udacity, have some pretty decent ones. But the trouble, I have to admit, I don't know what you think about this. So when I've looked at these, so we all learn, I think, pretty much the same way, because these, you know, I think Dreamweaver was the best we have, but other than that, we were pretty much learning, you know, it raw. Would you advise people use these courses? I mean, obviously give them a go, but I kind of think that they take away they kind of skip over a few steps in terms of, so what taught me the basics was working out how to get a local environment set up, working at this stuff myself. Kind of feels like that sunk in more.
Depends what you mean by the basics, Sam.
I guess what I find is when people, you know, have the courage to say, like, can you explain this stuff to me? I would often start at a level that was actually way further than I needed to. So I would start talking about even HTML and CSS. And I would realize that these people sometimes don't even understand how requests are made or how you see a web page, you know, and it's really kind of skating over quite a lot of very, very basic information, but actually underpins a lot of what we understand as second nature now.
Because, I mean, that's where I kind of get stuck over this kind of conversation, is that when we say that non-developers need to know the basics, are we talking about they need to be able to write basic HTML and CSS, or are we saying that they need to understand the basics of, you know, what role HTML plays, what role CSS plays, how, you know, a server works, those kinds of things. So is it theoretical or practical we're talking?
I think both ideally, but I think the theoretical is the most achievable. You can get a more of a broad spectrum, and it can help you in more of your work, I think, as someone not doing it on a day-to-day basis. Plus, when people are talking in meetings, it's not just jargon. You know, you don't need to understand. I remember reading an article about a project manager, and it was saying, are you a project manager or a project coordinator? And one of the differences they made was that a coordinator will do everything a project manager does, but they won't really make decisions. They'll let other people make the decision for them, even if their name's on it. Whereas a project manager will be able to understand enough to be able to make a call, I guess you could say, if need be.
Yeah.
That's kind of, it's a slight difference, but it's quite a big one at the same time.
Mm. Ryan, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we do hear a lot, it's been talked about a lot, this should designers code, and should other people, project managers and various other people on any given team code. I think there's a lot of value in developers understanding design as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Me and Dan, we very distinctly separate our concerns. So he focuses just on design. He doesn't do any coding. I focus on development. I don't do any design. But he understands enough of my capabilities and what we can do from a development standpoint that influences what he designs and what he puts into the creative aspect, because he knows what can be achieved from a technical standpoint. And I can implement that stuff because I have an understanding of the design concepts of color theory and, you know, typographical scale and vertical rhythm and those kinds of things that, it's amazing how many developers you meet who just can look at a design and go, oh, yeah, I'm going to implement this. And when you look at it and you'll say, well, what you've implemented don't look like what was designed. Yeah. And they just miss stuff. And it's like, well, can't you see that the font weight's different for these sections, and that draws attention to that area, and that button's a different shade of colour? Mm. You know what I mean? They just miss things that they just don't see. And there's value in having a basic understanding of what everybody on a team does. You know, you don't have to be able to do it all, but there's certainly value in understanding what the role of a project manager is, what the role of a designer is, what the role of a developer is, and then specialise in your one area.
Absolutely, it's that basic T-shape, isn't it? And especially if you're a project manager, I think you do need a very broad understanding of a lot of different areas. It's actually quite a challenging position. Sam, sorry, you were saying something and we ended up having cross-talk problems.
No, I mean, this is more on Ryan's point. The one thing I found about designers knowing how to code, it always seemed like a dilemma to me, because on one hand, I can see the logic in that, and as a project manager, and you know, it was a great thing, but I did start to find that the more we encouraged that, the more boilerplate designs became. I wondered if you thought is it the expertise or experience of a designer to understand how something's put together, but kind of suppress it so that the creativity isn't suppressed.
I think that's a very good point, and that's why we're getting a lot of these kind of, you know, design trends and stuff like that, where things just all look the same. I think speaking from mine and Dan's experience, I think in some ways he plays into it, and he's blissfully ignorant of the development stuff and pretends not to pay attention to what I'm telling him and stuff, because it leaves him to be more creative. And then I figure out how to turn what he's designing into a system and build in the consistency and you know, and sometimes that, I think that's where it lends itself well. I have like an understanding of design theory as well, because I can tweak what he's designed. I don't do it, well, sometimes I do it without even telling him, but I tweak what he's designed to be more consistent, like headings and sections and spacings and stuff like that, and then I'll just give him an overview of tweak this so that this is consistent, this is part of this system that I've built in for this project. But yeah, there's definitely, if you look at some designers who are far more kind of
Mike Cuss's designs, for example. Mike's very illustrative, and you know, the way he designs websites are very, very tricky to put into a system. I've worked with Mike, but it's because that's what makes his design so unique. And I think this goes back as well to what Andy was saying last week about style guides and stuff like that. We're losing some of the creativity in the web because of all these systems and frameworks and processes and grid systems and everything else that we're putting in. Everything's becoming really uniform, which is great from a developer's point of view, but we're losing some of that creativity and that aesthetic appeal that we could be putting in because we're making everything uniform.
Maybe that's the kind of point to leave it on then, is that yes, you know, people that can't design or code and vice versa, they should certainly try to understand it, but I guess keep that in mind all the time, that it's something to complement your primary skill, I guess.
Absolutely. Ryan, as you sharing stuff there, do you want to keep going and share your choice for the week?
So my choice for the week is a service called Algolia. And I think this is quite a developer-y service. So this is basically a service that provides search results. So you can integrate it, and there are lots of, it's very, very flexible in how you can integrate it into your system. But basically, instead of using like WordPress search or building your own search, you can push your content up to Algolia, it indexes it, and then returns you, whenever you search on your website, it returns the results lightning fast, like really fast. If you actually go to the website, they've got a little example that's accessing the IMDb API, and when you actually type things in, the results just flash up really quickly, and that's actually happening through their service live. So they take all the content, they index it, they cache it, and then it happens within milliseconds, and it's got some really nice, it's really flexible as well. So, you know, on the website you can see that they've got movies and the actors and the genres and everything else, they're all indexed and referenced. You set all this up through the service, and then basically with whatever CMS you're using or system that you've built, if you built something from scratch, like in Laravel or Ruby on Rails, or you've got something like Craft, which we talked about last week, or WordPress, they have various plugins so that when you save a blog post, that gets pushed up and indexed with Algolia. And then when someone uses your search field, the results are sent from Algolia lightning fast, faster sometimes than the local search could actually do it, because they're indexing and caching all the content. Wow. And it's we've used it on quite a few sites, and it's absolutely fantastic. And it plugs in with every, it just basically returns like JSON, which you can then just format however you want.
So is this actually caching information from the database rather than, it's not spidering like Google Site Search would do, for example?
So what it does is, it syncs, so it isn't accessing your database. So say you were in WordPress and you wrote a blog post and you click save, it pushed that content up to Algolia.
Right.
Algolia then caches it and syncs it and organizes it into all the bits of associated data.
Okay.
And then that's it. It's just sat there. So then when you request it, all you're doing in effect is requesting a static file. So it comes back really fast.
It is incredibly fast.
Incredibly fast. So we've used it for quite a lot of complex data on some of our projects, and it's really, really good. I wanted to talk about that. It supports, you can use whatever language you want. You can use Rails, Ruby, PHP, Symfony, JavaScript. You can do it purely in JavaScript. You can do it through PHP. You can do it through Ruby. You know, so you can use whatever language works for you, and then it just returns the results back as JSON, and you just catch that those results and then just format them on your page. But it's really fast. It's really good.
This is something that so desperately needs solving on websites, because most websites search absolutely sucks, doesn't it?
One of the things this does, and you can see the example on the actual homepage of that website, if you put mistypings in, like, because this is the IMDb database, if you put in like Interstellar but you spell it wrong, it still intelligently finds that it's supposed to be Interstellar.
Yeah.
It does little features like that behind the scenes. So it is really good. And they've kind of solved the problem of search.
Have they? What about things like kind of, obviously there's an algorithm that is working out what to return based on your search queries. Is there any way of tweaking that? So, for example, if you wanted to favor certain pages over others, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can prioritize various criteria. So,
great.
Not you won't just have a body of content being pushed up. Usually, you'd have categories and tags and authors and things like that. You can say that, right, I want to prioritize this by author, and those results will then come first. But yeah, you've got a lot of control.
Okay, cool.
And you can also create like what they call sub indices, where you can actually reorder the content in a different way, so that if you build a search bar and you say, right, I want to find this content, but I want to prioritize it by this field.
Yeah.
You've got your main index, and then you've got like a secondary index that's ordered by that field, and you can have as many secondary indexes so that then it's still returning it back just as fast. It's just accessing a different data set that's been organized in a different way. When you're first getting into it, it's quite easy to implement, actually. The instructions are quite, you know, for a developer anyway.
Yeah.
It's quite easy to implement. It's quite intuitive. There's a little plugin that you put into your system, and basically every time you hit save, it pushes it up and reindexes. Mm-hmm. And then whenever you do your search, it's got an endpoint where you send your search query to it and it returns the results. Mm. So, you know, conceptually it's quite simple, but you can do an awful lot with it. When you actually get into it, the scope of what you can do, because it's a very powerful platform. Sometimes I feel like we're like just promoting services, but this is what...
No, that's fair enough. No, I mean, you're not being paid to do that, and
no.
You're just sharing stuff that you use. That's like, I love it. That's what it should be. Looking at it, it looks like, you know, obviously it's ideally suited for something like an e-commerce site where you've got lots of categories and products and stuff like that. What about a content heavy site, you know, a blog or something like that? Is it the right solution for that, or are you better off with a more traditional web crawler?
This is used by Medium.
Okay, so very much so then.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anything that has search, you can use this.
Yeah.
So, you know, we always think about like IMDb in an e-commerce site.
No, that's true. No,
it's just got lots of cross-referencing data. So anything, it would work very well for an e-commerce site, but we use it on a project we've got, which isn't e-commerce. It's more of a social network.
Yeah.
You know, so, Product Hunt uses this, Periscope, Vivo, Medium, Twitch, you know, so anything.
Yeah. Cool. Very good indeed. Okay, Marcus, you want to happy to go next?
I'm very happy to. Excuse me. Yes, yeah, I was playing with Algolia.
Yeah.
I wasn't listening. I was going, that's quick. Oh, yeah, look, you can do that. Yes, I quickly wanted to talk about writing proposals and the fact that, especially if you've done it for a very long time and it's your kind of the main aspect of your job, which kind of is for me. You end up with an awful lot of boilerplate. You've written, you know, some really good stuff for different proposals over the years, and you think, I can use that one, and I can use that one, and you end up with this kind of, this perfect proposal in your mind that you've put a lot of effort into, and you end up wanting to just give everybody that proposal because you think it's really good. But actually, it might not be. It probably isn't what they want to read. Some of it might be. And if that's the case, then you need to take that content and rearrange it based on what they're asking for. Now, some people, their brief might simply be, you know, we want to build a new website. Tell us about yourself and how you'd approach it. And then you can just go, yeah, well, I've got this proposal that I've written previously that I can just wheel out. But quite often, excuse me, clients will have quite a detailed RFP, and I just had a quick little dig around on some of the RFPs I've received over the years, and found this one, which I thought was a really good example of the kind of thing that when you get a good brief, this is what people might say. So, in your proposal to us,
We would like you to let us know who you are, why you feel you're the right fit for us, and what special skills and talents your team bring to the project. So that's point number one. So basically all I'm saying here is you've probably got all of that content written in other proposals. Just make sure you deal with it first. What I quite often do is we'll, you know, maybe with a, you know, black background on white or something like that to highlight that point to say, this is what you said you wanted, so let us know who you are, why you feel you're the right fit, etc., etc., at the top of that section, and then just deal with each point one by one. So what that does is enable, before I go on to what it does, then the next point is describe how you would approach and manage this project. The next one is outline the key phases and outputs, etc., etc., etc. Deal with each one of those and you make them the headings of your response. And if you do that, then what that does is it gives the client the ability to really measure whether you're the right fit for them. Obviously, they'll want to meet you and all that kind of thing, but based on, they might have 10, 12, 15, whatever documents. If you respond to that their brief using what they asked for, then you're more likely to get through to the next spot. So that's my thought for the week, really.
And the reason I like that so much, Marcus, I mean, you've talked about that with me for years, and that's how you approach things. And the reason I like it so much is it really appeals to the kind of user-centric part of me, because essentially what you're talking about doing is responding with people's own mental model. So it's like creating an information architecture built around the user's mental model rather than the way you see the world. It's spot on. It's the obvious thing to do, isn't it, really? But it's amazing how many people don't do it.
It is, because especially if I use Pages for my proposal, which I love Pages because I can kind of be quite, you know, you can do lots with images and you can bleed them off the page and all that kind of thing. But what it doesn't do, what it does deals with very badly from an image point of view, is if you add content in, let's say I'm doing exactly I just described and I'm moving stuff around from my kind of boilerplate, so I need to have this bit first. If you do that in Pages, it messes up all the images. They all go completely awry. So you tend to end up not wanting to do it that much.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying here is make sure you do. That's all, really.
And it is true. I mean, that's another really good point, how much a tool can influence how you actually produce stuff. And that just generally, not, you know, almost goes back to our conversation about designs as well, you know, being influenced by the underlying technology. It applies in every area.
Maybe we should use something like Proposify.
Now, it's funny you mentioned that. But before we get on to Proposify, I want to hear Andy's book, because he's always got us a book, haven't you, Andy?
This season is all about books, but I want to bring it right back to where we started at the beginning of the show, which was talk about Trump a little bit.
Did we?
We mentioned
Civilization. That
we mentioned
it, yeah.
Civilization. Yeah. Pay attention, Paul.
Sorry.
And I was interested in the general standard of Trump graphic design, you know, across the campaign. So I've been kind of collating a whole load of kind of Trump stuff. I don't know what I'm going to do with it in the future, but it reminded me of Obama's, the contrast between Trump's graphic design capabilities, not his own, obviously, but his team's, and the stuff that went on with the Obama campaigns. And I was reminded about a book by Scott Thomas, who was on the original Obama campaign team.
Oh, yes.
I've seen him speak.
He's a brilliant, brilliant speaker and a really nice guy. And he produced this book called Designing Obama. It was back in 2009. And the only way that you could get this book was on Kickstarter. And you could buy the PDF or you could buy the hard copy book. And the hard copy book was really heavy and really expensive to ship here. And I've spent the last 7 years regretting not buying the hardcover book. So I'll put a link in the show notes to the original Kickstarter video and to the fact that this book's now out there on SlideShare. You can get the PDF. You know, if you just Google Designing Obama PDF, you'll find it. And so I was, with my sort of collection of style guide and graphic design manual books and things I've been buying over the last few months, I just ached for the fact that I didn't have this Designing Obama book, because I knew that lots of the kind of the process that went into designing the iconography, etc., was in this book. So I sent Scott a tweet and said, please, can I buy, do you have one of these hard copy of these books, you know, in your loft, or, you know, propping up a coffee table or something? And the lovely man wrote back to me and he said, yes, you can buy one. So I've actually now, after 7 years, got a copy of Designing Obama, and it is beautiful.
Even the PDF looks beautiful and inspiring.
It's fabulous. Anyway, that's not the book that I want to talk about.
You're just sneaking two in here. You're going to run out of books.
You can't buy that book, and I'm not going to plug a book. Well, I suppose you could plug a book. You can
get the SlideShare version. That's what I'm looking at.
I want to talk about the book that I wanted to talk about as well.
Okay. All right, fine.
Which is sort of still related to inspiration and things like that. Because, you know, all the way through this series, I've been talking about inspiring style guides, and particularly when it comes to layout and the fact that we're going to have CSS Grid to use very soon, etc. So I went through my kind of, I don't know, library of design and Devi books recently, because we've been packing up the office and ready to go to Australia. And I've sort of went through and I found a whole load of kind of my graphic design kind of grid layout books. And to be honest, flicking through them, I was really kind of underwhelmed. There's a few books that I kind of had on the shelf that I can remember buying and flicking through once. There's a book called The Designer and the Grid by Lucien Roberts and Julia Thrift, which I've seen a lot of people link to. The main one that came out a few years ago is this book by Coy Vinn called Ordering Disorder. I don't know whether you saw that. Coy used to be, I think he was creative director at the New York Times. And I can remember actually being given this book and not really reading it. So I went back and actually spent some time flicking through this book. And again, to be honest, hopefully he's not listening to the show, I was a bit disappointed, because it was all the usual kind of, you know, here's 12 columns and this is how you line things up approach. So I was thinking, there's got to be a good book about layout and things like that that I can kind of recommend. And do you know what? There isn't. This is a long story getting to the fact that I'm not going to promote a layout book. But there isn't really a great book about good layout for the web. So maybe there's a...
Are you lining yourself up to write another book?
No, bloody hell no. Sue said she'd kill me if I write another book. She said she'd hunt down and kill any publisher that would publish another book of mine. So
okay.
The book that I am going to talk about today, which I really, really do recommend, is called Editorial Design for Digital and Print. And it's by two ladies called Kath Caldwell and Yolanda Zapatera. And I absolutely love this book. And it was a really good source of good resource and source of inspiration for my art direction talk that I gave last year. And it's the book that kind of first reminded me again about Neville Brody's stuff. And it is a fabulous book. I mean, not everything is going to be applicable to what we do on the web, because there are sections, for example, about editorial formats and paper sizes and all of that kind of stuff. But what's really interesting about this book is it goes through everything from kind of creative concepts onwards. So it talks about briefs and how different designers have kind of accomplished the same briefs. It goes through lots and lots of components that we will have on web pages that could be thought of as kind of similar to what happens in magazines. So when the section that talks about magazine covers, we could as easily apply those lessons to what we see in those great big full width banners that everybody puts on top of their Squarespace and other sites. So there's all of that kind of stuff. And then also lots of kind of inspiration when it comes to learning about the anatomy of a page. So it couches most of it in kind of magazine terms. But, you know, we can think about contents pages in a magazine and think of those as inspiration for navigation on the web. And then there's lots of kind of type inspiration, and there's a few kind of showcase interviews with certain people. It mentions and quotes my good friend Mark Porter quite a lot. And it's just a fabulous book. It's slightly kind of, you know, off what we would normally expect to think of as like a web layout book. But there's so many things in here that if you've got a little bit of imagination and you think, that could inspire me to lay out this thing in a slightly different way, then it's brilliant for that. So I would totally recommend this book. It's called Editorial Design by Kath Caldwell and Yolanda Zapatera. And I'll put a link in the show notes.
Cool. Wonderful stuff. Thank you very much. All right. Well, let's wrap this baby up. Just talk very briefly about our second sponsor, which is Proposify, as Marcus has already alluded to. And actually, the one thing that we're talking about this week is about how you can use Proposify to help do exactly what Marcus was talking about, and to be able to customize and tailor proposals to individual clients, but at the same time still having a kind of reusable content library of sections, case studies, bios, you know, images, etc. So all nice and organized in one place, and get around exactly that problem that Marcus was having with Pages, where you can easily slot content in as required. Well, for a start, you can create templates. So you can choose to have a pre-designed template, or you can create your own and save it in a content library so you can easily find it next time you've got a new deal coming in. You can also then create individual little parts of content which you can save by tagging them, so they're easy to find later. So you could tag a section, a case study, fee table, biography, or whatever else, so you can quickly find them and then just drop them into the proposals within whatever structure you wanted. So you can again respond to the structure that the client sent you through in the brief. There's also a great versioning facility. So you can have several versions of the same piece of content, so you don't need to worry about losing any changes that you create. You can have several drafts of the work that you're working on and edit them, etc. Then there's things like fees that you can easily reuse from proposal to proposal. You can store them in the content library and just pop them in, whether that's fixed fees, monthly, hourly, whatever, however you work. And you can store snippets as well, which are short bits of text in your content library that you can then just drop in. So smaller little bits and pieces. And then, of course, there's the assets, product shots, infographics, team photographs, all that kind of thing, all held in one place. All of this not only gives you the flexibility to create proposals that are specifically designed around your briefs that you receive, but also makes it really quick and easy to put these proposals together, which at the end of the day, a lot of us have are having to do these things a lot faster than we'd want. So a tool like this will really help. You can find out more about it at proposify.biz/BoagWorld. Okay. Just before we wrap up, before we do Marcus's joke, just to remind people that we've got that Slack channel up and running that I seem to be spending more and more time in. I'm coming to despise Twitter with a passion at the moment. So increasingly, I'm just using Twitter for pushing out announcements and useful links and that kind of stuff. But if you actually want to chat, you want to talk about things, you want to discuss what we talk about in the show or get help or support or anything like that, then go to boagworld.com/slacking. And also you can recommend jokes for Marcus in the Slacking channel, which he desperately needs, no doubt, because they can't get any worse. Talking of which, Marcus.
Yeah, well, I'm actually not going to do a joke this week. I'm just going to relay the conversation about Trump's inauguration that was going on in the Bad Jokes channel, which was the fact that it's proof that he's already creating jobs for the unemployed because of the bands that were playing no one had ever heard of. But the best one of all, and this is just The Who should have said, yes, we'll play Donald, even though obviously they never would, but they should have done, and then they should have done, Who Are You, and Won't Get Fooled Again. How good would that have been? Aslan Catalan.
Good old Aslan.
Yes, just to think of that, I thought that's genius, but yeah.
That is very good. So there we go. Yes, we're having some really good conversations in the Slack channel. I so much more enjoy it. It's just every time. Going back to Ryan's comment, you know, Ryan's choice of the search tool. I made the mistake. All I did on Twitter was posted Chris's article, Marcus, that Chris wrote recently about Google site search and how easy it is to implement.
Yes.
Right. And I got a barrage of attacks over that. because I'm recommending a tool that destroys your privacy. And I should have more respect for my users than to implement Google Site Search that harvests their data, et cetera, et cetera. So I've just given up.
I saw that. And I just thought, but it's kind of just the nature of the beast, though, isn't it? People will always just have to put their two penneth in.
Yeah, and I know that, and that's fine. But that's why I prefer – you say it's the nature of the beast. I think it is a problem that is exacerbated on Twitter, that there is no way of creating a kind of standard for the community, a shared set of beliefs or values. And that's what you can do on Slack. You can say this kind of behavior is acceptable, this kind of behavior isn't. We talk about this, but we don't talk about that. And you can enforce some kind of rule there, if that makes sense, and some kind of community standards, because it's an invite only thing and not everyone can see everything you create. You don't have these kind of problems on Facebook as much, because Facebook, only your friends can see you. You can't follow anyone. So it's that lack of control of who you're talking to that I think makes Twitter quite challenging sometimes, in my opinion.
Oh, no, well, definitely.
So, yeah, I've lost interest a bit in Twitter.
I'm almost agreeing with you, Paul, but the echo chamber thing quite keeps me a little scared about just Slack, you know?
Yeah, and I understand that. The echo chamber is a good thing. Is it not a good thing? It is actually a valid point, but there are lots of different ways of addressing that. So for example, in what news articles you read and what stuff like that you pay attention to, I don't need that kind of feedback necessarily from a random person who I don't personally know, or I don't know how valid their opinion is. If I want a range of views, I will go to valid sources like, media or wherever else. That would be my feeling.
Okay.
But yeah, I do accept what you mean. Absolutely. So anyway, that's a bit of a depressing ending for the show. I didn't mean it to go down that road.
We need another joke.
Go on.
Do we? Okay, go on then.
Do that one.
Did you hear that Donald Trump has renamed the president's aeroplane?
No.
Air Force One. If you mess with America now, there'll be hell to pay. Did you hear about his new slogan for America? We shall overcome.
Okay, you can stop now.
That's enough. Lightened the mood beautifully.
Yes, thank you very much. And on that happy note, I think, let's leave it there and talk to you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.